Visa is synonymous with the credit card. But for all the oomph that Visa has there, they have the debit card market in an even tighter grip. Depending on what source you use, Visa facilitates 60 to 75% of debit card transactions in the United States. In comparison, they process just, quote-unquote, 50 to 60% of credit card transactions. It was not always like this. Visa first entered the debit card industry in the 1970s, but resoundingly failed. But when the late 1980s saw the rise of a potential threat to its formidable U.S. credit card business, Visa adjusted its strategy and swiped into action. In this video, the rise of Visa's debit card monopoly, specifically in the United States. Visa Inc. has a remarkable beginning, one that starts with a charismatic, rebellious, and contradictory figure named D. Ward Hawk. No relation to Hawk 10, the Broadcom genius. You might consider D. Hawk the most unlikely candidate to found what would eventually become a global $600 billion payment giant. Or maybe you might consider him the perfect candidate. I don't know. Born in 1929 to a Mormon family in Utah, Hawk grew up a classic country boy. He loved the freedom of the wilderness and was heartbroken to discover that life in the quote-unquote real world required him to navigate boredom and stifling bureaucracy. Joe Nocera, in the book Piece of the Action, paints D. Hawk as this contradictory mix of personalities. One moment, he can be overflowing with kindness, insisting that you take time off work or fighting the board for your bonus. The next moment, he can be a dark monster, pitting you against your coworkers, micromanaging your ad copy to the letter, and mercilessly cutting down your ideas in public. His leadership was something like half hippie and half Stalin. A former employee remembered how he used to say, "Titles aren't important around here as long as I'm CEO." And I think he acknowledges this dual nature to some degree. In his 2005 memoir, One From Many, he literally has these huge blocks of text where he talks about his old monkey mind, like as if it was a separate being. Very bizarre. Anyway, Hawk and his old monkey mind bounced in and out of various jobs, a canning factory, a slaughterhouse, consumer finance, before arriving at a small bank in Seattle called National Bank of Commerce. Hawk recalled back then how he fully intended to quote-unquote retire on the job. He just needed something stable to help raise his three kids and allow his wife to finish her degree in speech therapy. Hawk had a hard start at the bank, bouncing between its various departments, but he suffered difficult bosses and tasks with little complaint. His good attitude eventually caught the attention of Bank President Maxwell Carlson. The bank had recently agreed to license Bank of America's credit card, Bank AmeriCard, and Carlson wanted Hawk to help get the program up and running. Bank of America in San Francisco launched the bank card back in 1958 with the intention of creating an all-purpose credit card, something like the revolving credit charge cards that department stores or gas stations already had, but for everywhere. To publicize the card, the bank did its famous Fresno card drop, where 65,000 households in Fresno received active credit cards in their mail out of the blue. Things were a bit dodgy at the start. Delinquent account rates had been initially estimated to be 4%. They turned out to be 22%. But the bank cleaned things up and eventually saw the business grow into something profitable. In 1966, Bank of America started franchising its card to other banks outside of California. In such agreements, licensee banks paid Bank of America $25,000 and received the equipment and training, quote-unquote, on how to run a credit card program. Bank AmeriCard was by no means the only or first credit card of the time, but their success triggered the formation of a rival card called Interbank. Interbank would later change its name to MasterCharge and then MasterCard. Together, they spurred an explosion of credit card programs in the 1960s and 1970s. By 1968, over 250 banks licensed the Bank AmeriCard. There were 6 million cardholders, and processed sales volumes reached over $450 million. Back in Seattle, National Bank of Commerce did not really want to join the program. They did so only because they had to. So DeHawk and his colleagues went to San Francisco to be trained by the Bank of America team. What they learned troubled them. The training was all about marketing the card and had little about actually running a profitable business with it. An ominous sign. Back then, the credit card user experience was pretty terrible. Merchants had things called floor limits. If your purchase amount was over the limit, you had to wait while they literally called the bank for authorization. This regularly took 15 minutes, so merchants encouraged customers to use cash or write a check for such large transactions. And how are payments processed? Merchants use these manual imprinters called zip-zap machines. You put the credit card into it along with some layered carbon paper and run a heavy bar over it, leaving the card's information on the paper. The cardholder signs the paper and leaves with his copy. For purchases not made face-to-face, like purchases made via mail order or online, the merchant has to use a different method to verify the purchase, usually by collecting a billing address or a cardholder verification code. The signature method is not a particularly good method of ID verification. The sales clerk is supposed to compare the signature on the receipt with the one on the back of the card. Surprise, surprise, they're not good at that. Criminals would steal blank plastic cards, emboss them with fake information, and make fraudulent transactions. Add the fact that most banks had little experience in running a credit card business, and it is no surprise that by 1968, the system was on the verge of collapse. Nobody knew how much the banks would lose financially from their card programs, but it was a lot. Contemporary estimates regularly ranged in the hundreds of millions of dollars. But even worse than those financial losses was the growing perception that banks were not protecting their cardholders from card fraud or debt. Consumers especially hated being sent unsolicited credit cards. Such things invited the intervention of Congress, and Congress would indeed ban that practice in 1970. In October 1968, as the crisis unfolded, Bank of America called a meeting of its bank licensees. Hawk and others joined. There, the licensees were stunned by Bank of America's seeming lack of awareness of the whole situation. The meeting descended into acrimony. In the midst of the acrimony, DeHawk suggested that Bank of America create a committee of licensees to investigate the card program's major problems. Being the poor sap who came up with the idea, he was made chairman. What the committee's work eventually made clear was that the existing license agreements were unworkable. Bank of America was a competitor to its card's licensees. They owned the Bank of America card name and its trademarks and held the ability to revoke a licensee's agreements. Yet at the same time, there was no way for Bank of America to punish a bad bank or resolve grievances between banks, and contracts cannot be modified without renegotiating a whole new contract. There was no trust between the two and no flexibility. Over several months, Hawk and the committee comes to the belief that Bank of America's role was core to the problem and had to be removed, or at least edited. They come up with the idea of a new, unique organization owned by its member banks that would acquire the Bank of America card program from Bank of America and run it. It was a wild thought. Would Bank of America willingly give up control of their profitable card program? And would banks give up what control they had to an unknown third-party organization? Hawk goes to present the proposal to Ken Larkin, Bank of America SVP. A massive man, a former football linebacker, he listens with rising fury and immediately explodes, shouting and screaming that Bank of America created the system, runs it, and owns it, and no way that they were going to be pushed around by some tiny banks. But soon after saying this, Larkin calms down and politely ends the meeting. In the end, Bank of America had no choice. The program was indeed on the verge of collapse, and the bank licensees were willing to publicly leave the program and defect to Interbank, inflicting massive PR damage in the process. So thus was born National Bank AmeriCard, Inc., or NBI. They took over the handling of policies, advertising, and other operations. Hawk also pushed the company to computerize. Piggybacking on an idea by American Express, NBI implemented a nationwide automated authorization system called Bank AmeriCard Service Exchange, or BASE-1. Powered by off-the-shelf computer hardware, BASE-1 can handle thousands of transactions at a time, cutting transaction times to less than a minute and saving its members millions of dollars. It went live in May 1973, a year ahead of Interbank's own automated system, and was a revolutionary moment in credit card history, though at first, it can only handle transactions that were above a merchant's floor limit. The first ATMs in the mid-1960s were introduced in the United Kingdom and other parts of Europe. Early devices used paper slips, but later switched to ATM access cards. The British banks also popularized the concept of a personal identification number, or PIN, that allowed customers to identify themselves. In the late 1960s, the terminals reached the United States and started to get popular. The first ATMs were located only in a bank's local branches and only serviced its own customers. Banks and customers liked it, though, because it saved on labor costs and provided 24/7 service. In late 1971, City National Bank of Columbus, Ohio, issues America's first debit card. They didn't really call it a debit card back then. A contemporary news article just called it a magnetized bank card that debited from your checking account. These cards had a magnetic stripe, invented by IBM, and required a numbered PIN code to complete the transaction. The information is routed through various ATM networks and switches, resulting in the money being debited from the user's account instantly. In 1973, as NBI was rolling out its BASE-1 authorization system, Hawk gave a speech on what he felt was a troubling distinction being made by the banks. That distinction was between the businesses of issuing lines of credit to customers and managing those customers as bank deposits. To many bankers, these were two separate things. Hawk disagreed. By this point, he had concluded that money was just, quote, guaranteed alphanumeric data, end quote. His company's plastic cards can be more than just a line of credit. In the book One from Many, he wrote, "From the beginning, I believed in and worked for a transition from the concept of credit card to the concept of a transaction device for the exchange of value, a debit card, to use the jargon of the day. It was my hope that issuers would evolve from marketing the card primarily as an instrument for debt to marketing it as an instrument for the exchange of value." Hawk wanted his cards to be a generalized payment method so users can access whatever funds they wished, whether those funds be lent to them by the bank or held for them in an account. He called his idea the asset card. The asset card was intended as a direct replacement for the paper check, but with a few critical differences. One major difference was that payment was guaranteed. Banks have the option to reject a bad paper check, often by returning it unfulfilled, ergo the term bounced check. Such things can lead to fees. But NBI wanted their asset card to be like their credit cards. So like with the credit cards, if the merchant followed all the authorization rules, then they got paid, even if the cardholder doesn't have enough money in their bank account. Another critical difference had to do with merchants. NBI wanted their asset card to be accepted anywhere its credit cards were. This forced the asset card to use the same signature verification method that the credit cards used. In other words, signature debit. In 1975, NBI released their new product, which they named the Entree Card. Hawk said in the announcement, "We believe this is a major step in the evolution of bank cards and will provide substantial benefits to consumers and merchants." Visa thought that they had designed a very compelling product for both consumers and the banks. Some Americans were paranoid over potentially overspending and going into debt, not a minor issue. And there were certain things that you just did not buy with credit per cultural norms. Just like how millennials today make big purchases on the big screen, i.e. a computer, rather than a phone, Americans in the 1970s bought groceries and such with cash, not card. So the Entree fit their needs because it debited the money they already had in their accounts. And as for the member banks, the Entree card seemed like a winner too. It was not only a natural extension to their profitable credit cards, it would also save them money. Paper checks, for all their hundreds of years of tradition, cost banks and merchants a substantial amount of money, more than a dollar per check, due to physical handling costs and fraud. Debit cards eliminate the cost and difficulty of clearing and settling those millions of paper checks. So it was to the great surprise of NBI that nobody adopted the entree. What happened? One issue had to do with the merchants. Remember that Hawk wanted the entree to be accepted anywhere Bank AmeriCard was. So most merchants used the same old-fashioned ZipZap machines, authorized with the cardholder signing the receipt. In other words, the signature-based credit card method carried over to the debit card. These signature debit transactions, sometimes also called offline debit, were not only less secure, but also take about 2 to 3 days to settle. Considering these compromises, many customers stuck to the familiar paper check. Most surprisingly, however, the member banks resisted entree. Less than 1% of banks, about 130 in total, ended up adopting and marketing it. Why? A few reasons. Some banks were incentivized to make it take longer for checks to clear and settle. The time between when the check is deposited and when the funds actually settle is called the float. Ordinary consumers love the float. It lets them do things like write a check for a purchase on Friday and go to the bank on the following Tuesday to cover the draft. But banks like it too. They might use the float as a no-interest loan for earning extra money on the side, perhaps via a short-term bond investment. More efficient electronic check clearing and settling cut into the float and hurt revenue for certain payer banks. A few banks shunned the entree card's signature debit method, believing that the aforementioned PIN-based methods they already use for their ATMs worked better and were more secure. Finally, and most importantly, however, the banks saw fund transfer, and electronic fund transfer in particular, as fundamental to their business. Sure, credit cards are profitable now, but to the grumpy old-school bankers, it was still one step away from the pawn shops. Real banking involved collecting and servicing deposit customers, and to cede the future of their electronic funds transfer strategy to a third-party credit card organization would be a generational fumble. In other words, the banks didn't hate the idea of debit cards per se, they hated the idea of a debit card issued by NBI. When NBI changed their name to Visa in 1976, the entree card was rebranded to the Visa check card. Despite the name change, less than 100 banks adopted the product, and by the end of the 1970s, the trade press was starting to call it a failure. So in the United States throughout the 1980s, households typically had two cards. One of those was a credit card. By 1990, almost 65% of American payment cards offered some form of revolving credit. You bought things with it using the signature method. But the other card that they almost always had was an ATM debit card, issued to them by their bank for withdrawing money from an ATM via the PIN method. Over time, banks realized that customers wanted convenient access to their money, so they put more ATMs in areas outside their branches. ATMs started to show up on train stations, grocery stores, airports, streets, convenience stores, and so on. Banks then realized that they can create and share networks of ATMs, spreading out the upfront cost of installation. In the mid-1980s, regional ATM networks like Yankee 24 in New England and NYCE in New York started to grow. This was encouraged by a major ruling by the U.S. Supreme Court in 1985 that held that ATMs were not bank branches. This allowed these ATM networks to expand across interstate lines into national networks like Star or Pulse. In 1978, America had less than 10,000 ATMs. By 1990, there were over 80,000 ATMs, nearly 200 million debit cards, and over 450 million debit transactions conducted each month. As customers got more used to using ATMs, the networks realized that they can expand into a more critical space, the point of sale. This move began in earnest in the 1980s when a few supermarkets installed the terminals necessary to handle PIN debit transactions. Doing so allowed the supermarkets to offer a cash back option, where the customer can do a purchase and cash withdrawal at the same time. Man, I remember people doing this in the line at the supermarket when I was a kid. Now, this was a pretty compelling product, and it led the ATM networks to convert into more generalized electronic funds transfer or EFT networks that can handle transactions at both the ATM and point of sale. So one day, Visa rolls out of bed and realizes that it has some serious competition. The EFT networks' PIN debit cards debited customer accounts instantly, were more secure fraud-wise, and inflicted no overdraft fees. Most importantly, their networks' pricing for facilitating transactions were cheaper. Visa's debit card fees were structured like their credit cards, as a percentage of the total purchase price. By contrast, the interchange fees for PIN debit transactions were, back then, charged at a small fixed rate or even zero for some ATM networks. The fly in the ointment for the EFT networks, however, was that the merchants were not on board. They did not have the necessary point-of-sale terminals to handle PIN debit transactions. Part of the reason why was because the equipment was expensive and the merchants were not being paid to do it. The movement of payments and networks and who gets paid in a transaction is quite esoteric, so I am simplifying. But the key conflict was that the merchants wanted to be paid per transaction interchange fees as compensation for installing the new point-of-sale equipment, which can cost $1,000 plus each in a time when $1,000 was a lot of money. Worse yet, early EFT networks were not interoperable, so the merchants had to buy unique terminals for each card network they supported. And so there, the EFT networks and their PIN debit systems were somewhat stymied. Visa and MasterCard would repeatedly say that debit cards do not compete with credit cards. But the massive base of ATM debit cards, the growing regional EFT networks, and Visa's lack of representation in the debit market, just 11% as late as 1994, must have made them nervous. What if these regional networks consolidated into one widely used national debit card network? What if merchants finally update their equipment to take PIN debit payments? And what if PIN debit's lower interchange fees become the norm? To address the rising competition from the ATM networks and their debit cards, Visa pulled off two remarkable deals. In 1983, five of California's largest banks joined together to form a new point-of-sale payments network called Interlink. Interlink let customers use debit cards to make PIN debit purchases at participating retailers and restaurants. These five banks represented 50 to 60% of all the checking accounts in the state. Of the 8 million ATM debit cards in the state, they issued 6 million of them. Interlink was an attempt to get those users to use debit cards for buying stuff. Somehow, Visa's U.S. subsidiary won the contract to provide Interlink's technical backend. Interlink grew into one of the country's largest POS debit networks, turning the U.S. West Coast into a debit card pioneer and helping Visa learn how to process PIN debit transactions, and they later acquired it in 1991. Visa also acquired their own ATM network. In 1987, they paid $5 million for a 33% stake in one of the national ATM networks, plus, along with an option to acquire the whole thing. With these two transactions, Visa assembled the technology and network for their own PIN debit transactions. But a few voices argued that these two acquisitions also allowed Visa to monopolize and control the debit market and suppress a superior alternative. What happened soon afterwards would fan those fears. Throughout the 1970s and 1980s, Visa and MasterCard had competed ferociously against each other. So it was somewhat of a surprise in 1987 when they announced that they were teaming up for a point-of-sale debit card. The joint venture would be named, confusingly enough, the Entree Card. Yes, the same name as that first debit card product in the 1970s. MasterCard had their own national ATM network, Cirrus, so Entree users would be able to use ATMs in both the Plus and Cirrus national ATM networks. 1.5 million of these second Entree cards were issued, but none of them were used for making transactions because the retailers, obviously fearing the power of a Visa MasterCard combination, did not accept them. Then in 1989, 14 states launched an antitrust lawsuit against the joint venture. They also wanted Visa and MasterCard to divest their interests in Cirrus and Plus, as well as Interlink. They argued that Visa and MasterCard were trying to suppress competition by buying their way into the networks handling debit card transactions. They also alleged that Entree was an attempt to keep regional ATM networks from entering the debit card market. Visa and MasterCard argued briefly over this, but a year later, in 1990, they signed a consent agreement to terminate Entree. However, they were allowed to keep their interests in Cirrus, Plus, and Interlink. The antitrust battle seemed to have somewhat spooked Visa against making further inroads into the PIN debit market. For the next few years, their strategy and promotional funds focused on building their standing in the signature debit market, starting with the banks. In the early 1990s, Visa embarked on a major effort to get banks to add Visa branding to their ATM cards and accept signature debit. In 1991, the massive Chase Manhattan Bank, predecessor of today's JPMorgan Chase, agreed, converting 800,000 of their money cards to Visa-branded debit cards. Other large banks soon followed, supercharging Visa's share of the debit card market. The reasoning for this turnaround was both cultural and economic. Culturally, a new generation of bankers had taken over. The old-school bankers who so wanted to separate the credit cards and the deposits businesses were no longer around. Economically, Visa convinced the banks that they can earn more revenue from the percentage-based interchange fees from signature debit transactions, which at the time was 2% of the total value of the purchase. The banks chose the better-paying option. Retailers hate this, of course, but their card agreements with Visa or MasterCard require them to take all their cards, and that included debit cards. For certain Plum customers, Visa adjusted the merchant fees to make it worth their while. They did this for the supermarkets. Supermarkets hate how long it took for customers to write out a check, but also hate credit card fees due to their low margins. Visa lowered the debit card fees for supermarkets such that enough of them signed on. Debit card transactions continued to grow, hitting a total of 700 million in 1993. Even so, debit cards, PIN or signature, remained a small portion of the overall payments landscape. In 1995, debit cards represented just about 2% of non-cash payments at retail. Most people still preferred cash or ordinary paper checks. But this was about to change. Another selling point Visa had made to the banks had been a promise to back the debit product with a massive marketing campaign. In the mid-1990s, Visa came through with a huge ad blitz. They really emphasized the phrase check card, edging away from the phrase debit, which sounded too similar to debt, and directly repositioned the product as a convenient replacement for the paper check. Paper checks still survive today, but debit cards replaced them for smaller purchases. The average debit card transaction was about $40. At the same time, merchant equipment got more widely adopted thanks to large reductions in price. By 1995, swipe devices cost just $400, where a few years prior they cost well over $2,000. There was one final major trend. The emergence and rise of online e-commerce in the late 1990s favored signature debit due to its flexibility for handling remote transactions. PIN-based debit, more tailored for in-person purchases, never managed to get online the same way. Fueled by these three major trends and Visa's existing credit card infrastructure, the Visa check card and signature debit in general consolidated the market. In 1994, customers did 429 million PIN debit transactions compared to 279 million signature debit transactions, so PIN was strongly ahead. By 1999, the tables had turned, with 4 billion signature debit transactions and just 2.9 billion PIN debit. In 2003, 10.3 billion signature compared to 5.3 billion PIN transactions. This video has mostly focused on the US market. Assuming people care enough about this particular topic, I can do a separate one on Visa's dominance in Europe. They got that area in a lock, too. There are arguments that Visa's actions in the debit card market over the past few years were anti-competitive. In this scenario, PIN debit was winning out in the payments market and was the technically superior option. Then, big bad Visa leveraged their titanic credit card monopoly, with its unfair rules to honor every Visa card no matter what type, to enter the debit card industry and crush that technically superior option. In 1996, Walmart and other merchants sued Visa and MasterCard, alleging this exact thing. In 2003, the two card companies settled just prior to going to trial by paying several billions of dollars and drastically cutting their debit card fees. Then, in 2010, the Durbin Amendment and the Dodd-Frank Act capped the cost of a debit card transaction along with some other requirements. This largely ended any economic argument that PIN had over signature debit, since they now both cost merchants the same. All the while, debit card transactions continue to grow alongside that of credit. And today, Visa facilitates more debit payments than it does credit worldwide, though they probably make far more from its credit card's business thanks to these debit card limits. The debit card market has changed greatly since the 1990s, but Visa remains dominant. In 2024, the U.S. Department of Justice sued Visa again over its debit card monopoly, alleging that it is again using its size and importance to suppress competition and generate massive margins. The outcome of that court battle remains uncertain. Stay tuned. All right, everyone, that's it for tonight. Thanks for watching. Subscribe to this channel, sign up for the Patreon, and I'll see you guys next time.